introduce the court to you all, starting on my far left. Your far right is Justice Diane Sykes, and seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice William Babich, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, our hometown justice from Appleton and Outagamie County, Justice David Prosser. So we are now ready to call our second case, 00-3258, Carl Berg by his legal guardian, Gladys Weichert, versus the Cincinnati Casualty Insurance Company and others. We have Gregory Cook, who will have Kasdorf, Lewis, and Sweetlick of Warsaw, arguing on behalf of Cincinnati Casualty Insurance Company for 25 minutes. We have Victor Harding of Warshawski, Rotter, Tarnoff, Reinhardt, and Block of Milwaukee, arguing on behalf of Gladys Weichert. And then Mr. Rahan will do the rebuttal. So we are ready for Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'm Gregory Cook. I'm relocated to our Wausau office, and interestingly enough, this was the last case I tried down in Milwaukee before I moved up here. I think that the briefing that has been done by both sides in the case has been very complete and tried to address every case that we can find that relies upon or is maybe needed for your decision in this case. I'd like to start out by saying that this was a case that was very carefully and very fully tried, and that the credible evidence in the case clearly supported the verdict that was rendered by the jury. The jury was instructed on questions of negligence as well as lookout management and control, and I think it's important, even though we talk about Mr. Zimmerman's conduct, that there was clear evidence in the case that established that even though these vehicles were unlit and it was dark, that there was good lookout. Both experts agreed that there was distance that was available for the injured party, Mr. Berg, to have seen the snowmobiles and to have avoided striking them, and that's been carried out in our briefing. The key question, of course, turns on Section 350.01, subsection 9R of the statutes, which is one of the initial definitional provisions of the Wisconsin snowmobile statutes, the section on snowmobiles. And when you look at Wisconsin statutory interpretation, of course, the primary source is the statute itself. When a word is defined in a statute, that is the meaning that should normally be given to it, and that no other statutory interpretation rule need be applied in those circumstances. The statutory language here in and of itself was changed within the last 10 years, and it basically breaks out operation into two definitions. One is the exercise of physical control over the speed or direction, and the second is the physical manipulation or actual activation of any controls necessary to put the vehicle in motion.
Counsel, as I look at the statute, at least the one that's in front of me, there is an additional sentence under that. It says, operate includes the operation of a snowmobile. Is that part of the statute at the time that this case was tried?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
The obvious question is, why do they need that in there?
I don't know.
You know, we have to give meaning to everything, and if in fact operate includes the operation of a snowmobile, it seems to me that all the rest of the statute is superfluous unless we define operate to mean standing just as it happened here, and I'd like you to respond to that.
Well, we've debated that a lot since discussing the case, and I think that if just sitting on the snowmobile with the engine off, the lights off, and of course these snowmobiles cannot operate with lights on unless the machine is on because they don't have an independent power source. But
is that just a particular brand of snowmobile, or
tell us about?
What the evidence in the case established was the vehicles that were being operated by my client and his friend were brand new Polaris vehicles, and they had that feature.
They had that feature.
The vehicle operated by Mr. Berg was about a 20-year-old Skidoo model. That also had that feature. But there was nothing else that was brought into the case that established how prevalent it is in the industry or not. I think it's relatively prevalent, but I think some of the newer models now come with automatic starts and their own battery mm-hmm. power.
Can you get back to my
question? Yes, getting back to your question. When we thought about that, we looked at the first two definitions, and my feeling was that if the definition would include an activity as broad as just sitting on the snowmobile, then it would have been relatively easy for the legislature to say, as long as you're on that vehicle or in close proximity to it, and there's some cases that talk about proximity, or that you have the ability to exercise the right to operate it, then you're operating it. And that's how these drunk driving cases kind of all came into play. And those all seem to put, because of the public policy pressure to avoid anybody from hurting anybody in the operation of a vehicle, they have tried to draft the laws so that if you have the ability to put a vehicle in motion, then you're going to be determined to have been operating it. I don't see that here in our statute, and therefore I think that it would be, when you look at the first section which the Court of Appeals relied on, is to say that just sitting on the snowmobile constitutes exercising physical control over the speed of direction, my first question is, well then why have a second definition? Because that makes that definition superfluous. The phrase that you point out and that I didn't have highlighted here but clearly is in with the definition, operate includes the operation of a snowmobile, I don't know why that's in there. We're talking about a snowmobile statute. And so I have no explanation or answer for that. But I do think that if we apply it as broad as the Court of Appeals did, it makes other provisions in the statute superfluous. Because clearly physical manipulation or activation of any controls necessary to put the snowmobile in motion is a broader area than operating it. And, of course, in our brief we said the word exercise was key because we felt that exercise of physical control of the speed or direction meant action, meant that the vehicle was moving and it was in a position to, at least the way that the legislature intended it was, that was when your vehicle is moving and you're operating it. The second definition is it's not moving, it's not being operated, but you're trying to get it to be operated.
Counsel, perhaps, I don't want to say perhaps like you, but I never even noticed that part of the definition that Justice Babbage just referenced. Operate includes the operation of a snowmobile, and at first glance, because it's about my first glance, I wasn't focusing on that, it seems rather redundant. I mean, this whole chapter, 350, deals with snowmobiles. Thought comes to my mind. And that is, for instance, in Chapter 340, dealing with vehicles generally,
yes,
there are definitions that specifically do not apply to snowmobiles, or perhaps conversely said, that the definitions regarding vehicles in 340 apply to chapters 340 to 349 and 351, but not 350, which is snowmobiles. Could it be possible, this is not necessarily an argument you'd want to make, could it be possible that this highlights that perhaps operating a snowmobile might be different in definition than operating other vehicles? And that's why they put that there. Otherwise, it makes no sense to me why they put that there.
I would admit to the possibility of that. I don't think that's what was intended. It's clear that if you look at even the way the Pogler and the Modri decisions came down, that at some point in time the legislature did change and break out the definition of operation in a motor vehicle situation to address the drunk driving issues that have come up. And I think that at that same time, I think the last time this statute was, our statute on the snowmobile was changed was about 91 or 1990. So it was right around that particular time. And they broke it out similarly too. It's not exactly the same, but it's very similar in the manner and method that they broke it out. And I think they tried to address the same thing with regard to intoxicated use of a snowmobile. Interestingly enough, there's differences even in an intoxicated use of a snowmobile. In Wisconsin, even if you're intoxicated and cause injury as a result of a snowmobile, you do get a defense, which says that if you can show that the accident would have happened anyway, you won't be liable for intoxicated use of a snowmobile. That's a very interesting twist on intoxicated use questions. And you can operate a snowmobile in an intoxicated manner on private property, as long as you don't cause anybody injury.
Mr. Cook, this statute is intended to be a safety statute.
Yes.
Why shouldn't we interpret it broadly then? Because certainly if we take a broad interpretation of operation or operating, it seems to me we're fostering the idea of safety. What's wrong with that? That's really what the Court of Appeals did here.
I know, but the dissent pointed out some very interesting problems which will create only other areas that will come up with regard to litigation. When do you stop operating a vehicle? If just sitting on it constitutes operating, are you going to have a situation where somebody has gotten up and left and then came back and sat on the snowmobile for some reason? Are we going to have a close proximity test? If you were intending on starting that vehicle up, does that constitute operation? And I think that, yes, while it is a safety statute, and certainly the statute about not operating your vehicle at night is clearly the safety statute, this is merely the definitional portion of it, that there has to be a just, sensible stopping point at so that people know at what point they're going to be determined to have been operating the vehicle and at what point they're going to be determined to not have been operating that particular vehicle.
Counsel, would it be significant, and I know the second part of the question has to do with where the operation took place. This was on a roadway, but not one that was traveled, I'm talking about with cars.
Yes.
What if this took place on a, quote, this didn't, but I think your opponent talks about a snowmobile trail. And it makes a difference, I think, as far as how the question of operation is maintained, because if you talk about no sensible stopping point, I could imagine that I, for the first time, am breaking a trail, and I stop my vehicle, and I'm sitting there, it's off, and someone rams into me, then that would be a different situation than what we have here, or is that the same?
Well, I know that early on in the case, we researched whether or not this would qualify as a snowmobile trail. In fact, the DNR warden testified that it was not, that in effect, the rules of the road here applied as if this was out in the field. If you're talking about a snowmobile trail, and I'm becoming much more educated on snowmobile trails now that I've moved up to the great central northern part of the state, those trails are much narrower, they're marked, and in fact there are provisions that you cannot stop your snowmobile on a trail. And that, I think, is the distinction that's made here.
Counsel, I have another question.
Yes.
Going back to the first part of the definition, first of all, as I understand your position, you're essentially saying, I want to be fair as to how you're categorizing it, that operation essentially means running the snowmobile with the motor going and things of that sort. That's how I have
under
read your
first,
brief.
Under the first definition,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Now, I noticed that there are the statute recites four different ways of operating, and the word or, not and, but or, appears before each one. So it's speed or direction or physical manipulation or activation, which tells me anyway that any one of these constitutes operation with the word or. You don't have to have them all, because otherwise the legislature would use the word and. Speed and direction and physical manipulation. Now, I'll just point at one, and physical manipulation. I can physically manipulate a snowmobile without running it. Can't I? I could also control the direction of a snowmobile without running it.
You could physically manipulate the controls.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think you could physically manipulate the controls without running the vehicle.
So if in fact in this case Mr. Zimmerman, what are you saying, that let's say he was in the process of turning it around or putting it in a circle or something of that sort, or facing it in a certain direction, that would be operating it under the statute?
At any time he attempts to either physically manipulate or activate the controls or change the direction or change the speed, he's operating it, and then under that particular statute, he better have his lights on.
Even if the motor is not running?
Well, that's an interesting question.
It seems to me that the fact that the motor is not operating is critical to your case.
Let's say the snowmobile has broken down, and now he's trying to get it out of the way. He can't. He needs help. He needs somebody to either push or move it for him. And he can't get lights on the vehicle because he's got to have it running in order to have lights on it. I think a strict reading of that statute would be that if he was attempting, let's say he was on a downward incline and attempting to push that vehicle out of the way and steering it with the sled, he is, I think, under the definition operating, because there's no requirement that the machine has to be, the engine has to be running, or it has to be able to go under his own power.
So he'd be liable under that scenario.
Yeah, he'd probably be liable, although there was nothing he could do about it because he couldn't direct power to the vehicle if it was disabled and he was attempting to move it to get it out of the way. Yeah, I think you're right.
He had the power to move this snowmobile. He was sitting in the driver's seat. He had the keys in the ignition, if that's how you were.
Yes, he had the ability. The vehicle was relatively new, and he had the ability to start that up at any time he would have wished, and to move it to any position he would have wanted to.
Would your answers change if he was driving under the influence, operating under the influence?
We asked that question just the other day as we were debating this, and I think even the Court of Appeals dissent talked about it. If he was charged with operating, if he was intoxicated and then after the accident received a citation, under the development of the Modri and the Probler cases, he wouldn't be found liable because there was no movement with regard to the vehicle or no operation.
If we accept your definition.
We accept our definition, that's right. That's right. Now, that could be harmful to us, but that's right. He would have won under Probler and Modri's applications.
Probably that's why the Mothers Against Drunk Driving filed an amicus brief.
Well, I can understand their interest in this case and these cases, and we've read all the cases from the other jurisdictions as well. Those cases do not, though, talk about the same type of definitional language. They don't mention the term exercise, nor do they mention speed or direction. They want to make sure that nobody gets behind a drunk. A drunk gets behind the wheel of any type of a vehicle, and so they don't even want to give him the ability to operate it.
Now, the last half of this definition in 9R under the snowmobiles is exactly the same as the definition in 346.633.
The physical manipulation part?
Yes. Okay. So whatever we decide in this case about operate seems to me will have an effect on 346.63, the automobiles, because we're interpreting the exact same language.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. Does that create a problem for us in terms of intoxicated drivers?
I don't think so. I don't think any district attorney in this state has attempted to prosecute a driver of a vehicle that has not been physically manipulated or activated in any way. Remember the Progler case, the fellow was stuck up on a dirt pile, and in the Modri case, he was stopped on an expressway on the emergency lane with the car in park, but running.
Case where they're parked on the side of the road, no motor running, but they couldn't have gotten there without driving the car, right?
Right. We've never found any, there are no cases in Wisconsin with regard to that. If you look at the Cincinnati, North Dakota, Oklahoma case that's been cited by counsel, as well as the amicus curiae cases, and I, I pronounce that word very strangely. I apologize.
No one has decided how to pronounce that. That's not before the court.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that. But in the citation of those cases, there's different definitions, and so never really got to that point. Because in some of those cases, they found the drunk with the keys in his pocket.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't in the ignition. And in other instances, I mean, there were arguments that were made, well, this fellow couldn't necessarily have even had the opportunity to do it because of these other factors, and the courts have said no. Physical control is different. And so that's in those cases. So I think in answer to your question, I don't think it will create a problem. I think that this is on its face, the facts are very clean with regard to what Mr. Zimmerman was doing and what he wasn't doing. It's not a horse apiece. He didn't have the key maybe halfway turned on and was about ready to pull the lever. He was clearly stopped and had no intention of moving at that point in time.
Could I ask, snowmobile is on this pathway.
Yes.
Your position is that although the driver was on the vehicle, since the machine was not running,
yes,
it was not operating.
Yes.
But if it had been turned on, it would have been operating. Is that right?
Yeah, you mean if the engine had been running?
Yeah.
Yes, if the engine had been running, it would be operating at that point in time.
I suppose the driver had gotten off of the snowmobile and was over in a field doing something.
While it was still running?
Yes.
And the lights were on?
Well, maybe he didn't have them on.
Okay. If the lights were not on, then I guess we'd have to assume that something was wrong with the machine, because the lights come on when the machine goes on and they go off when it goes off. But let's assume for the moment the engine's running, the lights are off, and he's gone to get help. That machine is running, but I think as soon as he leaves at least some physical area around it, 5, 6, 10 feet, he can no longer be held to be operating the machine, because he has no ability to control it. He's not exercising any control over it. He's physically manipulated the controls necessary to put it in motion, but now he's away from it. And I can't even think of a drunk driving case that had a situation like that. For example, maybe they find the car running, but they find the defendant down the street trying to get away from the vehicle.
Counsel, but if you leave a running vehicle in a roadway, and let's come back to that,
mm-hmm.
This happened to be not, but that would be a question of negligence there. In other words,
yeah.
I think part of your issue is not only the question of operation, but where it took place.
Where it took place, yes. And remember, of course, the jury was instructed on negligence, and there was a tremendous and well-put argument that he was negligent for where he was, regardless of what the statute might say. It was just that the judge did not agree to find negligent per se and answer that question yes on the verdict.
Counsel, I think this case has the potential for huge implications for OWI cases. And I think it does if you start with the premise that operating in a snowmobile case means the same thing as operating in an OWI case, an operating while intoxicated case. If you start with that premise, then it seems to me that what applies here in terms of how we define it, then obviously applies in OWI. I'm not sure that premise is correct, but part of the problem is all the cases that are cited, or most of the cases that are cited, and most of the arguments are made, are OWI cases. So certainly that's the inference that you define it one and the same. But I'm not sure that premise is correct. But having said that, let's take your hypotheticals here. If I were an officer and came across a snowmobile that was running, lights on, and the guy, I watched him get off the vehicle, and he was in the woods 40 yards from the vehicle. Is he operating the snowmobile?
Based upon the eyewitness testimony that he had seen him operating it, then he probably is.
Because it's a reasonable inference, okay?
Because it's an inference.
Let's say
right.
The officer is there, and he comes up, and he doesn't see the guy actually on it. He sees the only person around is this guy 30 feet from the vehicle, and this guy is sitting in the ditch drunk. can the officer arrest him for operating a motor vehicle even if he isn't in the vehicle?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Let me submit yes. I don't know the answer either, but let me submit yes. It seems to me that it would thwart law enforcement, it would thwart credulity in some ways, to not be able to, based on reasonable inferences, charge this person with OWI. See, what I'm trying to do is to tease out what is it that means operating. And I'm wondering if operation in negligence is really viewed differently, because operation in negligence, it's important that you are operating at and immediately prior to the time. I'm wondering if that has any significance, because you can be charged with operating while intoxicated, even though you're sitting on a, what was one of the cases, the Moodley case or something like that. Let's say the guy's sitting on this little mound of dirt, tires spinning, engine off now. You know, the engine isn't running. He's been sitting there for 2 hours. Is he operating?
Well, you know, it is a higher burden, of course, in the drunk driving cases, because it's clear and convincing, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, it might even
is
be
he
higher.
Operating is the question. Whether or not they're going to win is another thing.
And
is he operating?
And under the definition in those cases, depending upon, you know, I think his ability to control that vehicle or operate, put that vehicle into motion, I think that the courts and certainly the public policy is, yes, he was. In this case, you know, This drunk driving stuff came right out of left field. I mean, even though the Progler and Mogri cases were the only ones where we tried to look at the terms operation, we tried to be very specific about this case, and of course there was, you know, there's no evidence of drinking in this case, there never was, and looked at it from a negligence standpoint, like you say, because many times the questions say at and immediately prior to the accident in the question. And clearly, when we looked at that way, and we looked at the definition, we'd have to throw out so many terms of the definitional portion of operate in order to squeeze Mr. Zimmerman into the point to say, okay, Mr. Zimmerman, even though you were sitting on that vehicle, even though it wasn't running, the lights were off, you were operating. I just didn't see it.
Counsel,
that's just damage.
One more devil's advocate, if I may, but I know you got a red light, but... Let me present an argument and then you answer it. That the argument that is that operating encompasses all forms of control, whatever, that occur from the time you start your snowmobile trip to the time you end it. Here, the snowmobile operation was clearly probably in the middle of a snowmobile trip. He wasn't pulling into a driveway or sitting in his own driveway or ending up, he was in the middle of it. And therefore, this statute says he's operating it because it encompasses all activity from the time you start it to the time you end that trip. How do you answer that?
Well, if the legislature wants to do it that way, that's fine. And I think it is a legislative decision. We're looking at the definitions that they made on it. That isn't the way, I don't think, that they intended it to be defined. And I'm certain that every snowmobiler out there, including Mr. Zimmerman, did not believe that if they turned their machine off and just left it quiet, that they were violating the law about operating without lights. And so I guess that's my response. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Harding, Attorney Harding.
Members of this honorable court, may it please the court, I'm Attorney Victor Harding. I represent Carl Berg in this case. The guiding principle upon which we're operating here is what was the intent of the legislature. That is our purpose in construing what they wanted done here. I don't think anybody doubts that the intent is that if you're going to operate something at night, that you have your lights on. Everything that moves, the legislature has written a law saying at night it's got to be lit up. Common sense dictates this. So the question here is, in the civil arena, which is where we are, Do we want narrow interpretations? Do we want fine construction? Or do we want, which will allow people to escape their responsibility, or do you want broad interpretations to effectuate the intent of the legislature, which is if you're operating something at night, you have it lit up not only to protect yourself, but to protect other people around you. It's in the criminal arena that we have narrow construction, precise interpretations, and we demand precise laws to be written so that an individual will know when he has stepped beyond the bounds of right and wrong. We do that because if we're going to find them wrong, they may end up in jail and lose significant rights. And that's why I think we have mad mothers in this case with a significant interest, because virtually every case outside of this one that's reported in the literature or in all the case law involves drunk driving. And if in those cases these individuals can be considered operating when they're sitting behind the wheel, but they may have the keys in their pocket and they're slumped over the wheel, or they're asleep, or they're on a mound, the courts are saying, yes, you're operating, and they pick up in virtually every case the language of actual physical control. And that's, I think, what we're really looking at. And these statutes, or the ones that many of the cases refer to, the statute that they were operating under used the term actual physical control or driving. And we have in our definition, actual physical control. It comes from 340.01, which specifically addresses actual physical control. That's the motor vehicle. Now, how does that come and apply to a snowmobile? If you go to 346.01, it pulls forward the definitions from 340.01, which includes actual physical control. Now, why do the rules of the road in 346 apply to snowmobiles? Because the legislature specifically adopted some 30 sections in 346.02 sub 10, 30 to 35 rules of the road are pulled forward and apply to snowmobiles. So therefore, actual physical control not only applies to automobiles, but applies to snowmobiles.
Mr. Harding, if I might interrupt for a minute, let me tell you something that concerns me about this case. We've got a situation where apparently the jury was told everything about the facts. Your argument was that the jury should have been told there was negligence per se here. How significant is that? Is that harmless error, given the fact that they had all of the facts and all of the circumstances in regard to this situation and could consider anyway the negligence of both sides?
No.
Why is it significant?
Because I was precluded from cross-examining their witnesses who came in and said 300 feet, okay? They came in with Mr. Scogan, their expert, who had done a study with snowmobiles that were similar, and he was dealing with retroreflectors. I think you've probably seen that term in there, which is nothing more than the red plate on the back that everybody has on their car that will reflect light back once it's hit, okay? And his conclusion was that I think at 300 feet you could just barely see one light, and at 330 feet you really couldn't see them, or it's in that area that it becomes indistinguishable with a background. And he says that's okay because that was enough safety margin for these guys to be able, or Berg, to see what was in the track, swerve, avoid, miss, or stop. Okay? But the legislature has taken the distance of 500 feet as the minimum safety distance, because that's the distance lights have to be able to be seen. And so what the court or the legislature is saying is that I don't care whether it's 300 feet or 400 feet, we're setting the minimum at 500 feet, and that's what's reasonable. And I was precluded from cross-examining based on a statute that set the reasonable standard, and I have an expert who's saying 300 feet is reasonable.
And you think if you'd been able to cross-examine that the jury's answer to a negligence on the part of the defendants would have been different, I take it. You feel they would not have answered zero.
Well, sure. I have the legislature in my back pocket saying what's reasonable. I mean, it's not what you people say or what these experts say. The legislature's already determined the minimum distance is 500 feet. And one of my cross-examinations of Mr. Scogan was, well, okay, if they had turned the sleds 90 degrees, would that have been reasonable? He said no, because the retroflectors wouldn't have been facing in the track, and it wouldn't have shot back 300 feet, and therefore your people may not have seen them, and that would have been unreasonable. So, yes, when counsel said the case was fully tried, I don't agree.
Let me ask you this. Suppose the trial judge had agreed with you, and they had given a negligence per se. What would the result be?
Well, we would have had a whole new trial.
Well, what would the trial have been? Would it have been on negligence?
No, contribution would have been the same. That would have been the same argument, except that now I've got that he had, realistically, my experts would have come in and said he could have seen them with his back at Malsheen Road, which is a half a mile back. He would have seen lights on these.
I'm going to rephrase it.
I'm sorry.
No. Would the judge told the jury, you should find as a matter of law, you were instructed that as a matter of law, the parked snowmobile driver was negligent as a matter of law?
I think it would have been answered yes on a special verdict.
Well, would they have asked the jury that, or would they have directed the jury to so find?
I think it's answered. Yes is put in the box for were they negligent. It's like we do with medical specials in this case. We're stipulated to the number was put in the verdict.
That's what I'm asking. So then when the jury would have to decide contributory negligence.
Which they did, which was lookout, mm-hmm. ability to be able to stop, react, avoid. For Berg, yes. And cause would have been left unanswered, I suppose, although I don't know whether cause would have been answered yes also by the court.
So the only thing different is the jury couldn't have answered that parked vehicle had no negligence.
Correct. And I believe, actually, when we refer, there's 2 points I want to make and get out before
your time runs out. We understand.
Is that once in 350, the definition of operate is even broader than actual physical control, which we pull forward from 340.01, because it includes a person who's responsible for the operation or supervising the operation is an operator under the snowmobile statutes. And responsible for operation includes a lot, is much broader, as well as supervision.
Snowmobile has an extra first clause. First clauses.
Well, it says an operator is a person who operates a snowmobile and responsible for it and supervising. And you don't get that in the automobile statute.
Right. Well, now,
and
Justice,
now I forgot the second point.
Could I ask, you talked about, Justice Crooks asked you about basically the facts coming in. And you said, well, on this 346 issue, that all the facts didn't come in because you weren't permitted to cross-examine an expert. What about 350.09? What, if any, deficiency was there other than the per se negligence instruction? Or
350.09 is the definition. 350.01 9W, that's the definition of operator. I'm not sure which.
I mean, the duty to have headlights.
Oh, all right. Yes. Okay. That's 09.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I have to get your question again.
The evidence that there wasn't a light went in.
Oh, certainly. Yes. So but the testimony was that was perfectly reasonable. That because it was all right to sit there with your lights out and your engine off. And it was Berg's fault because he should have been able to see them. He had plenty of time at 300 feet. A sufficient light would have blipped back to him from his own headlamps that would have rendered them their position. Now, there's a lot of other facts, because there's a this highway which is right next to it starts to curve behind in the distance. And this was from our expert, in that you really couldn't see them at 300 feet because the lights from the cars, and this was at rush hour, where headlights coming at you and red lights going in the distance, visually straight behind where these guys were sitting and Berg is coming, which clouded that ability. But, you know, the jury made up their own mind and did what they did. so, I mean, in my opinion, the legislature clearly wants lights on.
Okay. Could I ask you about this jury? It is not implausible to me that the jury would find the defendant's 0% negligent. It's not implausible. But I'm having trouble with the conclusions they came to on damages. How could they come to those conclusions on damages?
Because they didn't like the liability. That's quite common in jury trials, that if you're liability is close, they double bump you down on damages because of whatever they do. Yet if they like the liability or there's a particularly egregious defendant, they bump up the damages. It's not uncommon to see that. But so you get punished twice because they don't realize that your percentage of, if you do recover, that your damages are going to get reduced by your own percentage of fault. So you get double bumped down. But that's a fact of life.
Counsel, in the definition of operate, that's what I'm focusing on. Let me give you a hypothetical. Guy's been drinking in the bar, says to his friend, I got to go and sleep. You know, I can't take this. The friend, can I sleep in your car? Friend gives him the keys to the car because the car's locked. Goes, opens the door with the keys, puts the keys in his pocket, sits in the driver's seat, closes the door, sleeps for 3 hours. Is he operating? Can the officer come? And never turns on the car. He went there to sleep. Indeed, the only reason he used the keys was to open the car. Is that operating under your definition?
Yes. Because he has actual physical control and the ability to put the car in motion. You'll see that no drunk is going to come in and say and testify, because you can't climb in his head. He's not going to come in and testify that, oh, yeah, I was going to really start the car up and drive away, or, you know, whatever excuse there is.
I've received, as most of the judges here, you know, hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of excuses for OWI. But I'm talking about, let's pretend my facts are real.
That's why you see the definition being picked apart.
So here, a person who never intended to operate, who didn't do anything, never intended, that's a loaded question, never intended to turn on the car, never intended to go anyplace, just knew that he couldn't fall asleep in the corner of the bar, and he needed to sleep. He needed to, you know, he couldn't make it anymore. So if he would sit, counsel, if he would sit in the back seat,
yes,
is he operating?
Yes.
If he would sit in the passenger seat, is he operating?
Yes, because he has the keys. He could have left the keys with his friend. Friend could have opened the car door, let him sleep it off, take the keys away. But you cannot force the police to make an arrest by waiting for someone to start the car. This is terrible.
Under my facts, where there's no intention to start the car.
Right.
Let's say the guy, he knew he wasn't going to drive this car because he had been convicted 5 other times for OWI. And the penalty...
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way he was going to start that car. The penalty would be a long period of incarceration. He had no intent. Mm-hmm. He had no intent to drive the car. He sat in the back seat and fell asleep, and he can be put away for months, or let's say years if you get high enough in terms of OWI, for years in prison for that and be convicted on a criminal charge.
Yes. Especially if he's been hit 5 times before, he knows he shouldn't even get near a car. when he's been drinking,
well,
and he's got the ability to.
I'm playing the devil's advocate. I mean, I'm not here in favor. I'm not here in favor of drunk drivers, but he came in the back seat. He slept in the back seat,
right.
Only had the keys because he was sleeping in the back seat and sleeping it off, and we as a society can send him to 2 years in jail for that.
Yes.
There isn't any Wisconsin precedent for that, though. You're arguing based on precedent in other states.
10 other states have concluded that that is actual physical control and subjects you to criminal penalties under narrow constructions of language in a statute. But here we're talking broad interpretation.
I understand, but there is no Wisconsin precedent for the hypothetical that Justice Bradley is given, or for your answer that that would constitute drunk driving under the Wisconsin statutes. That no court has ever said that.
Well, there are unsighted or unpublished decisions, okay? And they deal with that. I can't cite it as precedent, and I don't know whether it makes a difference whether I can or not, because you're the de novo court, and you don't have to give credence to what they say anyways.
Why do the cops always feel the hood of the car to see if the car is still warm, has been recently turned off?
Well, because if you're going to ride on the inference that if they're, say, asleep in the back seat of the car, and then he has to prove either actual physical control or that they were operating it, and that's a reasonable inference from an engine being running, and if he said he was sleeping for 3 hours and the car is still warm, you have a conflict in intent.
Isn't there a problem here in trying to import the law in the drunk driving context to the situation we have here? In the drunk driving context, the courts have, it seems to me, expansively interpreted the definition of drive or operate to effectuate the legislative purpose of punishing drunk drivers, instead of just relying on, in the situation, for example, where someone is found behind the wheel of a turned-off car with the keys in the ignition, the hood is still warm, all of the circumstantial evidence that yields to demonstrate that this person was just moments ago driving or operating this vehicle while under the influence of an intoxicant.
But it's the same definition. You can't change a definition whether you're drunk or sober. Doesn't come into the definition of operating. Operating has these defined actual physical control, and so if you're going to construe in the narrow sense in the criminal situation where we have to have a precise right or wrong, why would you then not, why in the civil arena are we even here when you want a broad interpretation to effectuate the intent?
But the purposes are very different. The definitions may be the same, but in the drunk driving context, we're talking about what you can and can't do behind the wheel of a car when you're drunk, and here what we're talking about when you have to have your lights on.
No, but the safety requirements are the same. I mean, a drunk can make it home fine without killing somebody. On the other hand, the incidence of killing people increases dramatically as when you're drunk. And the same, it's a safety statute. We don't want drunks driving. They can do it. They can make it. But we don't want them out there because...
sailboat, and I'm up here in Door County, and I'm sailing for the weekend, and I have on my nice sailboat a little, you know, engine to help me out if I need to help it out, and of course I have if there were a key to the engine, I'd have it in my pocket. So I'm mooring this large sailboat, you know, nice bed underneath. Here I am at night, we barbecue a little bit, and then I drink, and I have way too many whatever I'm drinking. Can I be charged with operating a boat while intoxicated? When I'm at 2 a.m. because I'm sleeping, but, you know, I'm still had too much to drink. But this, I mean, I use the boat, of course, as partially a house. I sleep in it at nights. Under your definition, isn't it correct that the person could be charged with operating that boat while intoxicated?
I think he could, yes. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I think the answer is yes, because he is operating. But the lights also apply to sailboats, or even non-motorized boats at nights have to have lights on them.
Where is your boat?
You're all cordially invited.
That was my next question. Is it at dock, or is it sitting moored in the middle of the bay?
It's certainly anchored, moored, or drifting boats, because I think the law applies to them all.
It's not at my pier.
Right. It's somewhere on the water. It's a public pier. You know, it's moored, anchored.
Well, if I hear your argument right, Mr. Harding, you are arguing that when this exact precise words are used in one statute, namely motor vehicles, and those words are used in the snowmobile statute, they ought to be interpreted in the same way.
Para materiae.
Yes. They're, especially when you've got cross-references in each statute to the other.
Correct.
And your sub-argument, if I understood it, is that if the court's inclined take the position that the plain text means different things in different parts of the statute, then you're arguing that in a criminal statute we ought to interpret more narrowly than in a civil statute.
Correct. I think that's the law.
Is that, and that's your argument. And that's why you are consistent, or try to be consistent, with whether it's a boat or a snowmobile or a automobile, and it doesn't matter whether the guy is intoxicated or just careless.
Correct.
Your standpoint.
I mean, if Zimmerman had been on his sled drunk, would he have been charged with operating while under the influence but not operating requiring lights? That doesn't make sense. And you can't reward people for their misdeeds. I mean, everybody agrees that if he'd been sitting there with his engine running and his lights off, he would have been operating. Now, by turning the engine off, we're rewarding him for this misdeed. Okay. That doesn't make sense.
Well, both Justice Bradley in the argument and Justice Sykes have raised the issue that you can interpret the same words differently when you're defining drunk driving, and differently for defining negligence because of the purpose. And that what we're doing here, and I'm just stretching their argument, is that for negligence, you will give the jury the opportunity to make this decision, rather than instruct the jury, because that's what...
That's essentially
the basic thing. And you'll give the jury an opportunity to make that decision, because the jury has to make a decision of comparative and causal negligence anyway.
Oh, certainly.
Even if you instructed this jury the defendant is negligent as a matter of law, the jury is still going to say, yeah, but the other guy causally was more negligent, or causally was 100% negligent.
Certainly.
Or your client was 100% negligent.
Correct.
I suppose on instructional law, you can't find him 100% negligent.
If you found all three negligent and you couldn't find him 100%, I think that's probably...
That
you would
right?
have an inconsistent verdict at that point, I believe.
If you had an instruction on negligence per se.
Counsel, in all of the cases that you cited... I'm sorry, are you
done?
In all of the cases that you cited from other states, which you relied on in answering Justice Bradley's question, was the vehicle, when it was... when the person was arrested, was the vehicle clearly at a position that Justice Bradley described in the hypothetical, i.e. outside the tavern, and was not, had not been operated by this person? Or was the vehicle in these cases somewhere where it had to have been operated to get where it was, where the driver was stopped? In other words, I get back to the
Right.
Point that I made earlier in the argument, that it seems to me that in these cases, at least a common sense approach is to perceive something beginning and ending, a trip or something, and if it's at the, if in Justice Bradley's hypo anyway, there was no beginning. He just went off to the car to sleep it off.
Well,
so what? I'm not aware of the factual situations in all these cases.
They're all pretty much the same. They, you know, vary.
They're caught, they pull off to the side. They're in a ditch.
And the cop comes up and he finds them drunk behind the wheel, either the keys in their pocket or something else.
Because I suspect
and the court. I'm running out of time. I don't mean to cut you off. In those cases, the court is, they say, a little bit different, every one of them, but I think essentially they're saying is it's reasonable to make the inference that he was operating because he got to this point and he's drunk. But they say it really doesn't matter because he's operating, lying or drunk, asleep or whatever, behind the wheel because he is in actual physical control, and you don't have to wait for somebody to come along, for a policeman to come and wait for him to wake up, turn the car on, and then arrest him for drunk driving. They're saying it doesn't matter when you're in actual physical control. You are operating, and you're under the OWI statutes.
As I understand your argument, Mr. Harding, it's that the obligation to turn on the lights begins as soon as you sit down on the snowmobile, and it does not end until you load that snowmobile up onto your trailer or put it in your garage.
Certainly, if
it's nighttime.
Yes, you have the obligation, you know, wherever you are, to alert yourself to others. And this is an integral part of snowmobiling. I mean, people stop, they chat, they talk, let's go back, that was a fun route we just took, or let's go this way, or let's go that way. That is part of the overall integral snowmobiling.
When are you allowed to turn the lights off?
You can turn the lights off when you're done and you're not out in the trail subjecting someone else to injury or yourself.
So you're leaving, you have to obviously leave the motor running at all times.
Well, there are snowmobiles that have batteries, and you can operate the light independent. And certainly he should have done that. But
Mr. Harding, could I ask you about the first question and the special verdict questions?
Sure.
At or before the snowmobile collision, was the defendant, Robert Zimmerman, negligent with respect to the use of his snowmobile? Did you fight about the word operation in that, or?
I can't remember. I don't think I did. Use, I think, is.
What did the jury, were they instructed, or what did they understand? Was he operating when he was sitting there or not in the eyes of the jury?
Oh, no, we never got to use the term operate. That would never, I don't think that ever came up. I mean, it was.
Were they instructed?
Use was in use. I think Judge Momstead concluded that the term use encompassed sitting there on your sled, and that we don't have to get into this other stuff. That's a common term used in vehicular accident cases, at or before. So in the use of his vehicle.
You say in your brief, the court concluded as a matter of law, Zimmerman was not operating his snowmobile at night. Did
Correct.
The jury understand that? Were they told that, or?
No. They never heard anything about that because he had already ruled that the law didn't apply, so that I couldn't cross-examine, for instance, using the 500 feet. And
they were told that law didn't apply? Or?
They never heard about the law.
They never heard about the law.
What was the instruction on negligence?
It's just the
standard
1051
standard instruction.
Standard instruction.
Did you argue the statute about the lights on or not?
I argued that was negligence. That was unreasonable care for your own safety and the safety of others. I even cross-examined Mr. Zimmerman, who didn't care whether he was out there at night with the lights out. That's the last page of my brief, I think I cited, where I cross-examined, and he said that never even crossed my mind. Didn't care.
So you were permitted to argue that the lack of illumination on these snowmobiles constituted, and the fact that they were parked in the middle of a popular snowmobile area, at night was negligence. You just were not permitted a directed verdict on negligence per se, and were not even further permitted to argue to the jury that there was a violation of a safety statute, which they should find was
correct.
Negligence.
There was no safety statute or anything else that came into this trial. It was straight reasonable care.
But you were not prohibited from arguing the whole issue of the lack of illumination on the issue of whether the defendant was negligent or the two snowmobile drivers were negligent.
Well, what do you want this court to do?
Correct.
I'm sorry.
And then I think even Justice Curley, it's classified as a dissent, but I think she concurs for a different reason. She states quite clearly that sitting on a snowmobile at night in the middle of a track with black is negligence. And then in the last paragraph she talks about, well, I think the majority is distorting the term operate, and they should have really looked, was there sufficient evidence to warrant a no finding for Zimmerman and Layton, and reverse on that aspect.
And what do you think this court should do?
I think the court should uphold the Court of Appeals decision and send us back for trial.
On what ground?
On the ground that Zimmerman is negligent per se for operating a snowmobile at night without lights on, and that has to be answered yes, and then you will get to a comparison question, and it will be a whole different trial, and cross-examination will be a whole different case. Because I now have a statute on my side.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Harding. Attorney Hahn, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Anthony Hahn. I'm arguing the rebuttal on behalf of Robert Zimmerman, Cincinnati Insurance. If I may, I'd like to just basically start out by addressing this notion of actual physical control. Counsel cites Statute 340, which applies the rules of the road to snowmobiles, basically. But that statute in the first sentence states that the operation definition in that statute only applies unless there is no other definition. Where there is another definition, that definition applies. So if you turn to the definition of operate contained in the snowmobile section, Chapter 350, I think it's a whole different ballgame. You do not discuss actual physical control, but rather the exercise of physical control over the speed or direction. And in this case, I think that connotates some action on Mr. Zimmerman's part, and sitting on the snowmobile, I don't think satisfies that definition.
Counsel, just on the point that you're making as how you get from 340 to the case we have here. Your opposing counsel would argue, and did on page 26 of his brief, that the way you get to this, he would say, I recognize that 340.01, words and phrases defined, does not apply to 350 by its very terms initially.
Right.
But your opposing counsel would say, but ha-ha, I go to 346 sub 10, and that's what he does in his brief on page 26, and that says applicability to snowmobiles, and this is out of rules of the road, of course, 346. And it says, the operator of a snowmobile upon a roadway shall, in addition to the provisions of, and etc. And your opposing counsel in brief and argument indicates that means the term operator. He says the term operate and or operator in those listed sections is not intended to have a different meaning when applying them to snowmobiles as opposed to motor vehicles. So he would say that sub 10 gets him to have the same meaning. Your argument is that under 340.01, it doesn't have the same meaning because it is expressly defined someplace else.
That's correct.
And that someplace else is 350.019R.
Right. I believe that's the focus that we have to look at in determining this case. Because if you look at the actual physical control language contained in 340, then it's a different statute altogether. If you look at the case law and the statutes that counsel presents this court to find actual physical control, that's a much more broad statute. in each of those cases, it generally determines or outlaws driving or the actual physical control. And I think in this case, it's all different. Whereas the exercise of the speed or direction connotates movement, the activation or manipulation of the controls necessary is a much broader thing designed to prohibit that type of activity. For example, when somebody is sitting in a car, as we had in Pogler or Modri, with the motor running, that running motor is evidence that that person did manipulate or activate the controls necessary to start that motor vehicle.
So this boils down to whether the same words and two different statutes should be given the same meaning.
Right. I think that's what it boils down to. And if you look at the statutory language, I find it hard to determine that what Mr. Zimmerman was doing by sitting on this snowmobile talking to his friend could be determined either the exercise of speed or direction or the activation or manipulation of those controls.
But if it was a car and he was intoxicated, you'd come to the opposite conclusion.
No, I would not.
You wouldn't?
No, I would
not.
If Mr.
The motor would be warm here.
Well, then in that case, I believe that it circumstantially can be proven that he did operate that motor vehicle. I think the focus is on, in the negligence portion, as we talked about the difference between negligence and the criminal section. At the time this accident happened, what was Robert Zimmerman doing? And I posit to this court that he was not exercising the speed or control of the speed or direction or activating or manipulating the controls.
Thank you, Mr. Hahn. Thank you. Any further questions? Justice Prosser has a question.
What logical reason should there be for a different result when the snowmobile is on this path, in one place it's turned on and in the other place it's turned off? Why should there be a different result?
Why should there be a different result whether it's turned on or off?
Yeah.
Because in the situation where he turns it on, he's satisfying the requirements of the statute. He's activating or manipulating the controls.
Suppose the light isn't on.
I think then he'd be a violation of that statute.
Okay. So, but why should there be liability in one case and not in the other case?
Based on the language of the statute.
So even if it doesn't make any sense, we follow the statute. That's your position.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. That's my argument. I guess I don't understand what you're asking.
Well, it's what Justice Prosser is in effect saying, that if the motor was on, it would be negligence per se, because it falls under the statute.
Under activation and manipulation.
Right. 2 seconds later, the motor is off. He's in the same spot. He doesn't have lights either way, the way this would be set up. And same accident, and yet in one you say it's negligent per se, and in the other, depending on the 1 second of the motor being turned on, you say it's not negligent per se. Same exact fact situation except turning it on. So that, and you're saying that's required under the statute.
Mm-hmm.
If I hear Justice Prosser correctly, he's saying to you, does that make any sense? Does that make good sense?
Under a negligence per se argument, I believe it does. Because you have to look at the terms of the statute, and that's what he's trying to establish here, is that Mr. Zimmerman violated the statute. And I think you have to look at the word of the statute compared to his actions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I want to thank Mr. Cook and Mr. Harding and Mr. Hahn for presenting an excellent argument.